From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Papua New Guinea's capital fell into the grip of unrest yesterday as security force personnel stormed the national parliament. Shortly before MPs were about to debate the new national budget, hundreds of members of the country's disciplinary forces converged on parliament before some broke in and vandalized the building, demanding payment for work during last week's APEC summit. While PNG's government is urging calm and a return to normal after the unrest, the attack on parliament finds it's under growing pressure. To find out more of what's happening, we're now going to hear a little bit from Marvin Lengo, who is in PNG, Johnny Blades, who spoke to Dominic Godfrey.
At about 12 o'clock yesterday, frustrated police and correctional service officers conveyed into the PNG parliament to demand the APEC minister their allowances, which they provided security during the leaders' summit. However, prior to that, they had a meeting with the police commissioner, Gary Baki, who assured them of their money, but it was shouted upon. As the police commissioner left, they marched to the national parliament. I was there at the national parliament for the budget session when about 100 police vehicles carrying police and CIS officers drove in, and they started running towards parliament security guards and assaulted them. Later they ran into the parliament building offices and destroyed it by smashing glasses, doors and other furniture. They told me and other workers there not to take any pictures or they will smash our phones too. They waited for a few hours, till there was not any good answer coming out of the parliament, so they conveyed out as youths took advantage of that and started looting the big shopping centers and shops everywhere in the city as Port Moresby came to a shutdown.
Melvin Livongo. Now, while PNG's government is urging calm and a return to normal after the unrest, the attack on parliament finds it under growing pressure. Johnny Blades has been tracking events.
Yeah, well, it was just one of those days when Port Moresby descends into chaos, this mass convergence on the parliament by police and correctional service officers and their land cruisers. Whatever had transpired in their meeting earlier with the police commissioner and police minister, many left unhappy. And amidst the chaos of gunfire and these security forces convoys charging around Waigani, various looting incidents occurred in suburbs like Tokara and Edema, and Asian-run shops, as usual, were the targets of the looting.
So what's been the government and police commissioner's response to all of this?
Back at the parliament, as the attack or the vandalism abated and officers were called off as much as possible, the police commissioner and the head of the defence force met with Prime Minister Peter O'Neill and others in the government. And coming out of that, there were police and government statements assuring that the officers, the security forces officers, would be paid as soon as possible. The finance minister, James Marape, he was one of two or three leading MPs who actually went to personally address the security forces during or after the commotion at Parliament, issued a rather blasé statement characterising it as a misunderstanding, a sort of technical misunderstanding about the timing of payments and saying that the entitlements were now being processed. So it's not clear what the sort of consequences will be in the immediate term. The police may be expected to arrest some officers. The police commissioner, Gary Baki, is likely to announce an investigation or inquiry, but that usually doesn't produce quick or decisive results in PNG.
Now, these were security forces who'd been part of this huge security operation around the whole APEC summit.
That's right. They were members of the Joint Security Task Force, which had some 4,000 personnel in Moresby for the days up to and during the summit. Half of those were foreign personnel. But amongst lots of big military assets and this huge operation, they've been let down with the payment of their allowances, they say. And allowances are a significant need for PNG security force personnel who've come to the capital from other parts of PNG, all around those more remote provinces and so forth. The timing's really specific. You know, just after all these meetings and the APEC leaders summit had wound up, it's just the next day practically all this unrest has happened. These elements of the security forces obviously wanted to send a message to the state because there's a trust issue And, you know, police and security forces have been under-resourced for a long time now, and it's clear they feel they aren't being heard. And the problem of outstanding allowances and pay, it's been a long-running one for public servants and health and education workers too. So, unfortunately, the security forces' frustrations lapsed into violence yesterday.
And, of course, the purchase of a fleet of Maserati luxury vehicles can't have helped.
Well, that's right. That's the most visible example of the extent to which this government, led by Peter O'Neill, has gone to hosting APEC, which is obviously a huge event. And what happened yesterday is clearly a reflection of discontent among the populace and among the security forces at the government, and, you know, all about how it's approached this APEC thing, which apparently has costed in the order of 1 billion kina.
So how damaging is this for government itself?
Well, pretty damaging. It's just hosted this huge event on which it's pinned so much expectation for the country and devoted an extraordinary amount of money and resources to, only for this to happen the next day. I mean, it couldn't be much more clear. The government is sort of out of credit, if you will, with the public and certainly with these security forces. You know, after the unrest, the Speaker of Parliament condemned the breaching of the sanctity of the House, but this has shaken people. And, you know, at least one government minister has called for the resignation of the police commissioner, but Gary Barkey is the Prime Minister's appointment, so that puts some pressure on Peter O'Neill, who's just come off this especially busy week hosting the summit where the world's superpowers were butting heads. But scrutiny on the government, particularly APEC Minister Justin Tuchinko, is really heating up, I think, from the parliamentary opposition and civil society. And because of the controversy over the Maseratis and other spending items, they want Tuchinko to account for every toya of public money used in the name of hosting APEC. But, you know, I guess the possibility is that also, just like previous times when unrest sort of sparks in PNG's political hub, it swiftly retreats, and then it just remains normal, waiting for the next explosion while the root causes aren't addressed.
On the coattails of APEC, how big has this become on the international stage?
It's been well noticed, and I think a lot of those media who'd come to Port Moresby to attend the summit, they were covering this, you know, because they're probably still in transit, you know, not even far from PNG, that their attention is on PNG. So this is a bad look for PNG's government.
Advocates for the restoration of ABC shortwave services to the Pacific say the Federal Labour Party's proposal to restore the service to the Northern Territory could bode well for the region. The party announced this week that if elected, it will provide the ABC with just under $1.5 million to help reestablish shortwave services, which it turned off in January last year across the Northern Territory. The co-convener of a group of supporters of Australian broadcasting in Asia and the Pacific, Jamaya Garrett, says the announcement lends weight to the argument that shortwave is still crucial for keeping remote communities informed. She spoke to Corey Hawkins, who began by asking her who will benefit from the reestablishment of the Northern Territory's shortwave service.
So that's Indigenous communities, it's truckers, it's people who run cattle stations, it's more than 500,000 grey nomads who are out on the road in remote areas every year. I think the big thing about it is that it's put the lie to the fact that shortwave technology has had its day. So in that way, it's very significant. It's particularly significant for the Pacific because it bodes well for the potential to re-establish ABC broadcasting across the Pacific Islands.
So at the moment, $2 million only for internal shortwave in Australia, is it?
That's right, but the applications are very similar. I mean, people have been talking about the blue continent in the Pacific. Really, Australia is the brown continent with communities scattered in the same way across our rural areas. So I guess the precedent is excellent if it can be done for rural communities in Australia. And there we're talking at of a maximum of about 800,000 people. In the Pacific, of course, there's millions of people. So for pretty much similar amounts of money. So I think it does bode quite well.
And you will be, or have you already made a push to leverage off of this new development?
Well, yes, in fact, we will be, I haven't actually started yet, but I'm about to. And I think that there's an awareness in government. I mean, obviously we were disappointed not to see the Pacific announced at the same time as the rural areas. Possibly that's because there are currently two government reviews underway. And one thing I have noticed with with Labor in the lead up to our next federal election, which is in the first half of next year, is that their policy work is quite thorough. So they may be feeling that they shouldn't make announcements before those reviews report. I hope that's why the Pacific wasn't there. Not that it's been forgotten, but when you look at the new policies announced by on foreign affairs announced by the Labor leader Bill Shorten and also by Senator Penny Wong, there's a clear desire to do more and to do it very differently from the way the coalition government is doing it.
The ABC was very clear, well, the executive was very clear about why they went down this path. Do you see some resistance from them probably on the horizon?
Well, look, if you stand between a manager and a pot of money, it's amazing how it changes attitudes. But there's no doubt the ABC's attitude to this has been completely wrong. And, I mean, that's been shown by letters from a lot of senior people across the Pacific, including the Prime Minister of Vanuatu. I mean, I think one of the ways in which the Pacific could show that it's needed is to speak up. I guess the other way is to be aware of what's happening in Australia and the fact that what I'm really hoping to do and what I will be doing in campaigning on this is to ask where the transmissions will be coming from. Because, in fact, Shepparton in Victoria, which was the main transmission site for Pacific services, is also by far the cheapest place to broadcast to the Northern Territory from. So I'm really hoping that that's where the broadcasts will be coming from. And in fact, there are also three transmitters in the Northern Territory, which are actually more suitable for use by Papua New Guinea, Solomon Island and Vanuatu broadcasters than they are for the Northern Territory service. So should the service that Labor's promising come out of Shepparton, then I think there are opportunities there for the Pacific. So there's a few little hidden things in this announcement that people mightn't have realised by just reading the announcement.
And I guess in light of Australia's newly found or reinvigorated interest in the region with China and all of that, it's probably quite a important juncture to be starting this conversation again as well.
Well, indeed, I think for a lot of Australians who've got big connections with the Pacific, it's been immensely depressing to see how our media and our government seem to only take notice when there's geopolitical things going on. I mean, that's, I guess, why it was refreshing to see Labor saying that they're not interested in the region for strategic denial, but for being of use to the 10 million people who live there. Look, there's a lot going on. My one concern is that because these two reviews are happening, that just the broadcasting part of the picture, which of course has a very important role. I mean, Australia somehow seems to have a blank spot in the media about talking about the Pacific, but should Pacific broadcasting be revamped, there'd be much more of a conversation in Australia about what's going on in the region. I'm just hoping that because we've seen so many announcements with the new strategic concern, that they haven't drained the pot of money and left nothing for broadcasting. But anyway, I guess we'll have to wait and see, and hopefully that isn't the case.
Solomon Islands Parliament has just voted to pay each MP $47,400, calling terminal grants that they pay to MPs over and above their salaries at the end of the parliamentary term as the country prepares for elections. Solomon Islands is set for elections in March next year. Transparency Solomon Islands has long campaigned to do something, but its spokesman Ruth Lacola says this money, which comes out to a total of $2.37 million, is tax-free. She explains to Don Wiseman how controversial terminal grants came about.
This grant was given to them, or they awarded it to themselves, in the 9th Parliament. So they got it the last Parliament. So we've been raising it with Parliamentary Entitlement Commission, as well as in the media and with public, that this is not fair at all, and it's also unjustified to give themselves these huge amounts of money for doing what? They have been there to just siphon off public funds, but now they're awarding themselves this. And I think the issues we have is if you go back to the challenge that citizens made, that is where the problem lies in the first instance, that the Court of Appeal judgment more or less said that the Parliamentary Entitlement Commission is more or less a mini parliament on its own, and therefore has the legal right to make any awards that they wish to make, and it's not unconstitutional to give them those grants. And so we've been trying to raise public awareness on this to see if the people can continue to put pressure on the PEC and the government to make the changes. There was a public inquiry into the independence of the PEC, and the recommendations of which are still not acted upon as far as we know. But specifically for us at TSI, we believe that this tax-free 400,000 grant should be taxed like anybody else's long service benefit for the public servants is taxed, any allowances of anyone is taxed. That's number one. Number two, it should not be paid out. If it must be paid out before the election, it should be paid out after the election and only to those members of parliament that did not make it back to the parliament. Number three is the awarding of this grant on the eve of the election does not create a level playing field when it comes to the general election. So those are our issues, and we continue to raise it with the government in media and with the responsible authorities. But it seems to have fell on deaf ears.
So the money has always been intended essentially as something that the outgoing politicians could use to contest the coming election?
Well, they do use it to support their campaigns. I think in 2014, Transparency Solomon Islands and other CSOs and other bodies mounted a really effective clean election campaign, but it fell on deaf ears because the same thing happened. They released the 400,000 at the end of the ninth parliament, and also during the course of the last 4 years, and the course of the CDF money has been used to support the foundation, support the numbers of voters to vote for existing members of parliament. And at the same time, through this various stealing of the public funds, it is very, very difficult to bring about intergenerational change in leadership, as well as getting really good leaders who have a vision for the country and for their constituency's development to get into parliament, because they can't match the 400,000 terminal grant and also the millions that were released through members of parliament in the name of constituencies. So it's really having an impact. And the last registration that we had, everybody is voting where they think they will get the most benefit out of the constituency development fund. So the constituency development funds and these terminal grants are actually influencing the voting patterns of the people in the way that it should not be in this country.
At the beginning, it was an amount of money set aside for retirement, but it's become this thing that all the MPs get, and they get it to bolster their election coffers.
Yes, and the other thing that we're calling for is currently there are 10 members of parliament that have been investigated by the police, and they should not be releasing any of that 400,000 to any of them until the investigations are complete.
Papua New Guinea's biggest ever international event was dominated by friction between the United States and China. At last weekend's APEC meeting in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, when it ended in controversy with leaders unable to reach consensus on trade and deciding not to issue their joint communique. But there were also some gains for PNG, as Donnie Blades told Tim Glasgow.
So at the summit, there was a cluster of announcements of aid and development projects in Papua New Guinea. For instance, New Zealand announced that it would be joining this big project to provide electricity to something like 70% of PNG's population, which is electricity is greatly needed over there and greatly lacking presently. They'll be joining Australia, the US, Japan in implementing that project. So New Zealand will be contributing only about $14 million of a total project bill of about $1.2 billion. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern also announced something like $7 million for this immunisation campaign in PNG. Obviously, it's a response to the ongoing problems with old diseases re-emerging like polio and stuff. But also, you know, the US, its Vice President Mike Pence, who was representing the country in the absence of Trump, announced that the Americans would be joining this naval base plan, a plan for a naval base on Manus Island. That's a plan with Papua New Guinea and Australia. Apparently it's PNG's initiative, but that very much is seen as working to counter China's rising influence in the region, if you will.
China's president arrived a day or two before the summit and seemed to grab a lot of the attention as he presided over the opening of some big Chinese development projects.
Yeah, he really did. And I think, you know, one of those big projects was this six-lane road in Port Moresby, and there was much fanfare around his presence there because I suppose, unlike Trump, or let's say Russia's president, Xi actually turned up, and he was certainly feted by PNG's government. And in fact, there were Chinese flags all around the city. It was as if it was a small part of China. So it's clear that China really has this huge and growing influence in PNG at the moment. That was really evident during the APEC summit.
So is this some sort of bidding war between China on the one hand and the US and Australia on the other?
It sort of has a ring of that, but PNG's Foreign Minister Rimbenk Pato has been at pains to say, look, it's not a bidding war. PNG is friends to everyone and enemies to no one and has a right to choose between development partners. PNG really has looked to capitalise on this summit with these two sort of sides almost vying for influence in not just the Pacific, but especially PNG with its strategic value.
And the PNG foreign minister was also at the centre of an alleged incident involving Chinese officials, right?
So apparently Rimbenk Pato was in his office overseeing the drafting of the summit statement, as it were. And there was a lot of conjecture about that because there are a number of matters on trade which China was not happy about the wording in that statement. And four Chinese officials were reportedly trying to see Mr. Pato at this time. He wasn't able to see them because he had to remain impartial in his position as chairman of this particular process. So he wasn't able to meet them, but they reportedly barged in, according to the ABC. The PNG officials called security and then the Chinese had to leave. But Mr. Pato himself and his spokesman have denied this. They said that once the Chinese understood that he couldn't see them for that reason of having to be impartial, they left, you know, there was no trouble, no issue. But it has been kind of interpreted in the Australian media, at least, as this sort of sign that China is perhaps bullying or pushing its weight around. But the friction between China and the US on trade was really evident at this summit. And that's why at the end of the summit, the leaders weren't able to issue their normal communique.
And there were reports that China actually imposed some restrictions on media while at APEC.
There were two instances where Chinese officials reportedly barred both local and international media from attending events at this summit. It happened with the Pacific Island leaders meeting on the sidelines of the summit with President Xi, which is a huge opportunity, you might think, and yet media weren't allowed to cover that. And that's also why there's a bit of a scarcity of detail about that particular meeting, what came out of it. But also, again, just adding to these sort of concerns that China is less than open in the way it deals with other countries.
Much of the island of Saipan in the Northern Marianas remains without power and water as recovery efforts continue in the wake of Typhoon Yutu. The island's international airport resumed daytime flights Thursday, more than 20 days after being hit by the superstorm. Regular nighttime flights should be starting this weekend. Public schools are scheduled to reopen on December the 5th. Altogether, this happened a week earlier at the nearby island of Tinia. Northern Marianas correspondent Mark Rabago told Mackenzie Smith, Saipan is still in full recovery mode.
In our parts of the woods, we already have power, but the south side of the island, basically the island is cut in half right now, those who have power and those who have not. So still not back to normal, if you can say that. But there are some, it's faster than when Sotoro happened in 2015. In 2015, we had to wait like 3 months for the island to be energized. And that was because the construction was centered around the northern and central part of the island where the power plant was located, or is still located. And at this time, when Super Typhoon Yutu destroyed the island, it was mostly the destruction was on the south end of the island. So it's faster than Sodilor, but half the island still has no power. And water, I think, is only 65%. In terms of recovery efforts, everybody's pitching in. There's more than 1,000 military and federal personnel on the ground right now, and they're helping from removing tree debris to fixing schools. The schools are still out until December, I think early December, so public school students will still be on vacation until the officials here, the public school officials, sort things out. They were thinking of trying to relocate some schools to other schools and having two shifts, one in the morning and one for the afternoon, to accommodate students who lost their schools. The recovery period is still ongoing. Those who were in evacuation centers were actually moved to southern end of the island where evacuation centers actually have running water and power, so they'll be more comfortable. And also so they could fix the schools that were really damaged by Yutu. So that's where we are right now.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@gmail.com, or you can write our general email address, pcjmedia@gmail.com. Once again, pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.
As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.